On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On September 10th, 2001, Elizabeth Buemiller took her spot as White House correspondent for the New York Times. The next day made history. The next nearly 5 years saw the Bush administration push executive powers and presidential secrecy to head-turning new frontiers. Buemiller covered it all from her vantage in her way. Now she's off the White House beat and talking about reporting on the controversial presidency of George W. Bush at a time when the White House press corps itself has come in for scathing criticism for unquestioning pressroom stenography of the administration line of the day. Up next on Point, the New York Times' Elizabeth Buemiller on covering the Bush White House. Joining me now from Washington is Elizabeth Buemiller. From September 10th, 2001, until a couple of weeks ago, she was a White House correspondent for the New York Times. She also wrote the weekly White House letter during that time, looking for the more intimate face of the presidency. She began her career in Washington during the Reagan administration as a style reporter for the Washington Post. Elizabeth Buemiller, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You write that very few people, including your own bosses, envied you this time at the White House. Is traditionally a pretty high prestige position. We can imagine why they don't envy you, but you tell us, why was this considered, has this in recent years been considered such an unenviable post?
Well, I guess, I mean, it is considered a good job. I should say that for starters. It's one of the toughest jobs at the paper, and it usually goes to people who've had tough beats elsewhere. I came straight from City Hall. I was at City Hall bureau chief covering Rudy Giuliani's in New York City. So that was pretty tough in itself.
Right, it's top of the heap. But yet you write you were rarely the envy of anyone.
Right. Well, this is true. A lot of people think it's a terrible job because of the many problems with the beat. Obviously, the biggest is the tough. It's so tough to get access, and the perception that White House reporters are just a herd, and you're herded from event to event, and you just write down what goes on in the briefing, and it's a very limiting job, and there's very little opportunity for original, creative, incisive reporting. And that's certainly the perception out there, that you're in the bubble of the White House.
So you're
I found that not to be the case. I mean, you have to work very hard to make that not the case, but that was the challenge for me.
You had one of your bosses saying that he didn't think he could stand to cover the beat for a single day. It's famously a tough administration on the press, fairly open contempt at any number of points. At the same time, there's a huge line of criticism saying the White House press corps isn't tough enough here. Some
right.
conservatives, lots of liberals saying that. On balance, looking back, Elizabeth, where did you get your toughest criticism from? From the right, from the administration, from the left, from those outside wishing you were tougher? How would you frame it up?
I got it from everybody, I would say. I got it from everyone. I got it from the White House. I got it from the right. I got it from the left. I got it from my bosses were tough, obviously. We need more stories. We need better stories. I got it everywhere. I mean, that was the interesting thing to me, that the beat changed, really. It was evolving. I mean, White House correspondents have always been criticized. My husband, Steve Weisman, covered the Reagan White House 20, 25 years ago, and there were this was not unusual. I mean, this was the standard then, that the White House press corps was too easy on the president. But it's intensified in the last 5 years with bloggers, with the internet, with email. And so I got it from everywhere. And I think I was kind of stunned in the beginning. It intensified during the 2004 reelection campaign. And I was kind of just stunned by it at first. But then it's just part of the job. If you take this job, you're a semi-public figure, I've decided, and it's just part of the deal. And in some ways, it gives you some sympathy for politicians, Republican or Democratic, this is part of their lives too. And you just learn to focus on what you think is legitimate criticism and try and tune out as much of the rest as you can.
We'll talk about that, but I wonder if you see it, felt it in yourself or in others, does it lead to, I don't know, paralysis? I mean, Dick Cheney, for example, no mean guy to bare his teeth. I mean, he went right at Senator Leahy on
right.
Capitol Hill, let alone reporters.
Right.
So on that side, it's pretty tough. On the other side,
you know, especially now with all the bloggers out there, you've got, you know, people will say anything. I mean,
right.
You really took the brickbats, you know, the eternal sunshine of the Buhmiller mind. It's very clever. But they went at what they called your warm sponge bath of feel-good imagery, propaganda so stupid and crude it would have embarrassed the Chinese commies.
Right.
Is that paralyzing?
No. I mean, first of all, I didn't have time to read a lot of it because if I'd read it, I wouldn't have been able to do my job. It was too time-consuming. And secondly, you kind of just a lot of it is politically focused. You know, it comes from the left or comes from the right. The right's it's pretty horrible, too. And so I just you can't. I mean, I went. I got up every morning and went to the office and did my job. You know, you just and it's also become so over the top in the last couple of years that it's become sort of background noise. You know, I mean, I know when I get a good letter or a good email and and they say you didn't cover this aspect or that aspect, and I pay attention to it. But this kind of stuff you're talking about, you kind of have to tune it out. Otherwise, you couldn't do your job.
How do you understand what the White House correspondent job is? You know, of course, one of the criticisms is the stenography criticism.
Right.
The executive moves policy across such a huge front that you can't cover every consequence of decisions made there. Yet, if it's only, you know, their statements, that's clearly insufficient. How did you conceptualize your job as White House correspondent?
Well, you know, there's many different kinds of White House stories. My ultimate goal was to write stories about what was really going on inside there, and not just the statements that come out every day. However, if you cover the White House for the New York Times, and I would add that there were three of us, David Sanger,
yep,
and Dick Stevenson and myself, there's a mix of stories. And so obviously some of the stories are the president said today. The president has a news conference in the East Room. You're going to cover that and write down what he says and then include the Democratic criticism or whatever else you can get at that point. If it's in the evening, it's hard. So there's all those kinds of stories. The president goes out to Yuma, Arizona, and stands on the border of Mexico and talks about his immigration proposals. I mean, that story you just do. It's part of the bread and butter of the beat. But the other stories are the ones that you try and, find out what's truly going on. I mean, I did a story about the stagecraft of the White House, about how the which got a lot of attention at the time. Actually, I was on NPR about it, about how the White House has worked very hard and learned from the lessons of the Reagan presidency to put the president in these very beautiful settings, and how much pageantry and theater went into the president's public statements. I mean, so that took
a while. The apex maybe at the mission accomplished moment.
Right. That was actually, it ran shortly after that because that was the high or low point, depending on your point of view, for that kind of theatrics.
Let me ask you about a few things you've written about recently. You allude to, and I'd just like to know more about them. You say that the public impression is, and you call it a misperception, that the White House doesn't care about the press. You say, in fact, they pay lots of attention at their 7:30 a.m. senior staff meeting every single day. Evidence, you say? Well, here's one. Laura Bush once excoriated me during an interview for something you'd written in the last paragraph of a sort of obscure spot in the paper. How does that work? What's it like when Laura Bush excoriates you?
Well, it's not especially pleasant. I mean, it's not, you know, I was interviewing her about, it was actually a very good interview. It was in early 2004, and she was starting to do interviews about the campaign, the reelection campaign, and she was very tough and she was very feisty. It made for very good copy, but she was, I guess I could say that this White House has issues with the New York Times.
But I mean, was she chewing you out? Was she red in the face? Was she shouting?
She was mad about something. No, she wasn't shouting. She just was saying you shouldn't have written that and you knew it was wrong and you wrote it anyway. And I, I beg to differ. But, she had a lot of other issues about the paper and sort of vented with me. She wasn't yelling. She was just talking very firmly and forcefully and she wasn't happy. And, you know, I defended the paper and myself, and we moved on. It happens. I mean, when you cover an institution, people get angry with your coverage. It's happened since day one of my time as a reporter.
You say more recently, Karl Rove was so mad about an article that he told you he was putting your email address on his spam filter. In other words, nothing from you was getting through. What made Karl Rove that angry?
It was, you know, it's funny, these things. Carl has a bit of a temper, I think that's safe to say. Let's see, what was it this time? It was a, It was very minor. It was something I'd written about the White House energy policy. It was in about their conservation efforts after Katrina, when oil was skyrocketing in the fall of 2005. And it was something, it was a White House letter. I had written it. It was about, it's not that interesting, I'm sorry to tell you. It was about,
but it was enough to take you right onto his spam list.
Well, I don't know if he actually did it, but he threatened. And I just, I said, okay, you know. And Karl Rove has a temper, as it's fair to say. He gets mad about a lot of his coverage.
If complete transparency in an administration was 100%, what percent of this administration's workings do you think the public gets to see through White House correspondents like yourself?
I mean, if complete transparency?
Is 100%.
What was the question?
If 100%, if complete transparency was 100%, what portion of the workings of this administration do you think we see or understand through the White House press corps?
Oh, well, I would say, much of it. You know, I don't think we're quite as dreadful as everyone else does, but I think a lot of us do a good job. I mean, people criticize the press, but how do they know about, you know, suicides at Guantanamo? How do they know about, debates over Iraq between the State Department and the Pentagon? How do they know about, you know, I think there's a lot that people know about the White House and this administration because of our reporting.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New York Times White House correspondent of nearly 5 years through most of the Bush administration, now out, Elizabeth Buemiller. She's out and looking back. Let's listen to a moment to the kind of thing that goes on in that White House press room. Here's July of 2005, famously, infamously, when Karl Rove's name arose as part of the Valerie Plame scandal. Then Press Secretary Scott McClellan went into full no-comment mode. NBC White House correspondent David Gregory kept hacking away.
Scott, can I ask you this? Did Karl Rove commit a crime?
Again, David, this is a question relating to an ongoing investigation, and you have my response related to the investigation, and I don't think you should read anything into
it. They have told me they are not involved in this. Do you stand by that statement?
And if you will recall, I said that as part of helping the investigators move forward on the investigation, we're not going to get into commenting on it. That was something I stated back near that time as well.
Scott, this is ridiculous. Do you stand by your remarks from that podium or not?
And again, David, I'm well aware, like you, of what was previously said. And I will...
There's the wall. No comment, no comment, no comment. Right. Elizabeth Buemiller has been up against it. 800-423-TALK is our number. You were talking about comments from bloggers.
I was just saying it was in Maureen's column over the weekend where she said, very well-known, successful bloggers said, well, I don't care about, you know, we're not interested in getting facts or reporting. We just want what you guys do that so we can comment and, about what you write. So I still, obviously, I'm a big believer in the old-fashioned reporting and collecting facts and putting them in the paper. So that's what people sometimes forget that we're not columnists, we're not opinion columnists. Our goal is not to, our goal is information.
Tell us about your path to the White House. How does a reporter end up there with the New York Times?
Well, I don't know. I'm sort of a funny path. I started out at the Washington Post as a style section reporter. I started out as a party reporter covering, when I was in my 23, covering parties in Washington. The idea was not to write about the flowers or the food, but to write about the politicians who were there. So I covered parties at the State Department. And
Sally Quinn, the executive that Ben Bradley's wife had picked you up, kind of found you and brought you in there to the Post.
That's right. Found me at Columbia Journalism School, I should say. And so I did that for a while, and then I started doing profiles for the style section. And then I got married. And
to Steve Weissman,
I married the White House correspondent for the New York Times, mm-hmm. Steve Weissman. Mm-hmm. And then
was he a classmate of George W. Bush at Yale?
Yes. He
Were they buddies? Did they know each other?
They were acquaintances. They were class of 68, mm-hmm. and they had tangled a bit. Steve was working for the Yale Daily News, and there had been some issues over coverage of the Deke fraternity in the Yale Daily News. And so early on Bush's in my family, there was we tangled with the Bushes.
Mm-hmm. And from Style to White House?
No, and then I went to India. Steve became Delhi bureau chief, and I went to India and wrote a book about Indian women, and then we went to Japan. I wrote a book about a Japanese woman, and then we went to New York, and then I started working for the Times in 95 out of New York on the Metro staff, and then became went to City Hall in 1999 when the mayor was thinking about running against Hillary Clinton.
And then on from Rudy to the White House on September 10th. A Cincinnati girl. Your mom was Danish, right?
She still is. I mean, she's naturalized American now.
And then into the White House seat. Describe for us that Washington situation. Well, here you are covering this, but you're also living there. Your husband, you know, went to college with the president. People know each other. You've got to both work and live in this environment. Is it possible to be full-on aggressive in your job and still have a livable existence in Washington?
Sure. I mean, I it's what reporters do all the time. It's not the White House isn't any different than covering, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York, or, you know, it's not any different than covering an institution that you, it's not any different than any other beat, you know, covering, you know, Boston City Hall. That it's just, you know, every day you go in and try and find stories. And when you write stories that they get upset about, they yell, they complain to your editors, and you move on. You know, it just, it's part of the give and take of a beat. This is just in a much, you know, bigger stage, that's all.
A bigger stage, but also with an administration that went to war, where the argument for war is now widely discredited, where the press role in reporting or not reporting that run-up to war has been so widely criticized, where the executive authority being expanded like crazy, secrecy just, you know, by any objective measure expanded like crazy. I mean, that is a particularly tough time. We heard Scott McClellan there in that clip. It's sort of an adamantine face to the world. How do correspondents get through that, or do you?
Well, I would just want to say one thing. You're talking about all these stories. Well, how did you know about these stories? You read about them in the New York Times, right? We found them out for you. So I just want to tell you, give us some credit here.
Credit where credit's due. I mean, we're trying to look at it in a very open-eyed way, including the Times' own kind of mea culpa after the war.
Right.
So yes,
we learned things.
We didn't learn things. It's a combination.
Right. But there's been a lot of focus on our coverage of the run-up to the war. Mm-hmm. But I also want to say that we also broke the story about the domestic eavesdropping.
Sure.
And
James
so there's
Risen
been a lot of stuff we've done that I just want to point out to people that a lot of what we've done has been, I think, and I'm not going to include myself, this has been superb reporting about the secrecy of this administration, and day after day after day. And obviously the stuff about the war has gotten all the attention, but my God, the story that we want to pull it through for the domestic eavesdropping story. So I think the Times and we have, and again, as I said, we are not the favorite newspaper of this administration, to say the least. You know, Cheney has kicked us off his plane and the whole bit. So how do you do it? You go in every day and what we would do, you know,
you described a kind of concentric circles.
Yeah, the concentric circles. I mean, people always thought, you know, people who see the briefings think that, well, a lot of people thought my job was just to go to the briefing at noon every day and you know, listen to Scott McClellan or Ari Fleischer before him, Stonewall, and then go and write some story. That, as I said in the piece I wrote, it's a very minor part of the job. It's, you can hear, you know, it's good theatrics, but it's very little information coming out of it. It's also a big chunk of the day. It's 45 minutes to an hour you sit there. And so what we would do, David and Dick and I, you'd think there would be something going on, and you would start with, you'd often start on Capitol Hill. There's 535 people up there who know stuff and who often are upset with the president. And
you start with the in crowd, the out crowd, the upset crowd?
Yeah, there's a lot of people up there. You know, the president has people in. They've recently talked to him. What did you hear? You know, then we would always, there was a lot of what I call, you know, the Republicans close to the White House who would all talk to.
I've always wondered when I read that phrase, does it mean Ken Mellman? Does it mean Republican officials?
It means a
buddies?
Lot of different people. It could be lobbyists in town who are very close to White House senior officials. It can be former party officials, people recently out of the White House, and they can be very talkative because they're constantly in touch with people in the West Wing. They were very good sources, and they're semi-official because they sometimes they would tell us things that they knew the White House wasn't going to say, but the White House wanted information out.
You know, they were actually set up to tell you. Were they spinning you then? Is that how it works?
Some, yeah, there was a lot of spin. Some of it, but some of them were disgruntled, so it was spinning the opposite way. I mean, I've been a reporter for 25 years now, so you sort of, you try, you think you can, I think I can usually sniff out where the spin is coming from. And whenever you talk to anybody as a reporter, you always have to figure, why is this person talking to me? What is this person's motive? It's not to be nice to me. And once you figure that out, things are a little clearer.
And what about the president himself? You say, you write, most regular White House reporters have a friendly, towel-snapping relationship with Mr. Bush.
Well, that's true. You can sort of see that at the press conferences, that there's this sort of joshing, give and take and stuff. And he's like that. But I don't, this president does not like the press. It's obvious. And I think it's become more so over the last 5 years. So what you see is a joshing relationship in the news conferences. It makes some of our critics very angry. But the president does that in large part to look like a regular guy, to make him seem more, human.
No relationship there? That's just theater, too?
Oh, no, there is with some reporters. I mean, there's a give and take. There's no, I can't think of any reporter there's no friends among the press that he has.
Elizabeth, if you would, we've got a lot of listeners who want to join us.
Sure.
I want to begin to bring them in, if I could. Jamie's calling from Mount Vernon, Virginia. Hi, Jamie, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to make a comment. I think that the press needs to be relentless in pursuit of information with this administration. The arrogance that they show, which seems to be born of some kind of executive privilege that just oozes out of every pore, is driving me nuts. I don't think we've seen anything like this since Nixon or possibly earlier. And I think the founders would be astonished to see that these people do not consider themselves outwardly to be servants of this public by offering information to the Republic.
What about the job that the press is doing, Jamie? Is it up to par?
I'm sorry, say again?
Is the press, has it been up to par? Has it been bringing you what you need as a citizen?
The press?
Yes.
I think all due respect to most of the press and my son who's in journalism school, I think the press chickened out after 9/11. I think they really chickened out after 9/11, lost their nerve. And that precipitated this sort of cascade of fear of questioning anything. And you saw it in the Congress also. I think had the press been more diligent, more bold early on, that the Congress would have wimped out on a lot of decisions also. I think it has precipitated throughout the entire society, and I think it needs to change. The press needs to be relentless in pursuit of truth.
A cascade as a result of not being, you're saying. Jamie, thanks very much for calling. Elizabeth, how about it? You've been quoted saying that you and your colleagues found it after 9/11, that is the day after you were assigned to the White House, frightening to stand up there. And no one wanted to get into an argument with the president at this very serious time. Is Jamie on to something? Did the severity of that blow knock the press back on its heels?
No, I think that actually was, look, you go back and you look at those press conferences, those primetime press conferences, and people need to go back and look at the questions we asked and tell us that you thought we were frightened.
You said it was frightening.
Yeah, you were looking at some bloggers. I said that in a, I think I said that at a journalism school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I went, and by the way, that was a press conference where I stood up and asked a question about whether or not he was going to go back to the UN for a second resolution. That was the news of the press conference. So the idea that I was frightened. But, what I think that
but,
I was
But it
talking
must
about,
have been frightening. I mean, we're trying to sort of get at the nuance here. I mean, you said
no,
it was frightening.
No, it wasn't frightening.
You said it was
frightening
to stand up there. No one wanted to get into an argument with the president.
I did it over and over again for 5 years. Of course, you stand up in the East Room on prime live-time TV and ask the president a question. It's not the most relaxing experience. But
this is about the post 9/11 atmosphere, I guess you were talking about, and how keyed up the country was, the White House and everything else.
But look at those questions. I mean, they were not. I disagree with that, and you're not going to get me to say that we were not tough on this president.
So it was frightening, but you're not saying you didn't do your job. It was frightening, and you stood up and did it anyway.
I did a great job asking questions at those press conferences. You go back and look at the questions I asked and the questions that my colleagues asked. Listen to, you just heard David Gregory, you know,
battering on the, give it to us, Scott. Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I don't.
So what do you think of the impression that,
obvious.
What do you think of Jamie's impression then? Here's a citizen. He calls in and says, I'm
very
worried.
I think it's very common. I think it's also, as he said, it was said of the Congress. I think it's, but I maintain that I thought we were plenty tough on this White House. And there was obviously after 9/11, this coming together of the country, you know, and it really, after 9/11, you know, the president was, he was what, at 80% in the polls, 90, I don't know what it was. So there was, we were very unified then. And but of course that all came apart after Iraq. So no, there wasn't. I don't. Obviously, none of us, nobody in Congress, it was questioning our course after 9/11 in Afghanistan. But you know, much later after in Iraq, yes.
Let's take a call from Sandusfield, Massachusetts. Kit's on the line. Hi, Kit. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have been reading Elizabeth Umula for 5 years, and I am delighted to see her in this morning's Times. Again, despite the fact that she's taken a leave, but there's a very good piece in this morning's paper. But I think her writing, first of all, is terrific. It's good, honest reporting, and especially given this very difficult White House atmosphere. But it's good writing, and it always has a human interest. And so I will miss her a great deal.
Thank you.
I also love On Point, by the way.
Thanks very much, Kit. Thanks for calling. There you go. Fans out there, too, Elizabeth. Take heart. What about the human interest side? You had the weekly White House letter. It had clearly a fan in Kit and many others. It got a lot of brickbats from some saying this is, you know, putting a kind of comfy human face on a monstrous administration. How did you look at that style section background and what you brought to your White House coverage from that?
Well, I don't think it was putting a comfy face on the White House. I mean, you need to go back and look at some of my White House letters. One of them recently was about the, well, not too recently, it was earlier this year, about the president's signing statements and about how he had used, you only read that in the White House letter. You didn't read it anyplace else in the New York Times, and you didn't read that too many other papers either until later, about how the president was using, was signing legislation and with statements saying that he was only going to take what was said in the legislation under, you know, as an advisory.
Right. Legislation as a suggestion.
It was, yeah. So that was a White House letter. You know, so I think a lot of this was just because the columns were very readable. And they did write about people, but they weren't all positive about the people. And I think it was just part of the... It was just a natural criticism. I also think it's partly directed at women when they write about things that aren't hard news. That's just part of the deal.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New York Times White House correspondent through most of the Bush administration, Elizabeth Buemiller. Here's Elizabeth Buemiller, March 2005, in a particularly punchy exchange with the president over his choice of former Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz to head the World Bank.
Elizabeth.
Paul Wolfowitz, who was a chief architect of one of the most unpopular wars in our history.
That's an interesting start.
Your choice to be the president of the World Bank. What kind of signal does that send to the rest of the world?
Well, first of all, I think people are... I appreciate the world leaders taking my phone calls as I explained to them.
Elizabeth Buemiller throwing the president off his stride for a second there with her introduction to the president, Paul Wolfowitz. Then there is the White House Correspondents' Dinner not so long ago. Stephen Colbert, satirist behind the Colbert Report, skewered President Bush and took on the White House press corps itself. Let's listen to that.
Listen, let's review the rules. Here's how it works. The president makes decisions. He's the decider. The press secretary announces those decisions, and you people of the press type those decisions down. Make, announce, type. Just put them through a spell check and go home. Get to know your family again. Make love to your wife. Write that novel you got kicking around in your head. You know, the one about the intrepid Washington reporter with the courage to stand up to the administration? You know, fiction.
Laughter, but not too much there. It hasn't been the most fun time. It's been an unenviable time, at least from the outside, Elizabeth B. Miller says, to cover the White House. You can join us, 1-800-423-TALK. So there you were, sort of putting the screws on the president about his choice of Wolfowitz. There were other times. I mean, one story of yours that really got people's attention was in May of 2004, the other long occupation, Bush in a bubble. You described the president as out of touch, and almost deliberately out of touch with national issues. What was the blowback when you'd land a punch like that, Elizabeth?
That story, Bush in the bubble?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't hear anything about it, I don't think. I don't think...
Karl Rove didn't cut you off his email list. Laura Bush didn't excoriate
you. No,
you
know what? They would get mad. The things they would get mad about. Let me think. The good things. Other thing. Oh, there was one time when I wrote that in this that Don after Abu Ghraib, right as it was blowing up, that Don Rumsfeld had thought of resigning, and the Pentagon went crazy and. Called my editors, and it was, you know, it was this huge, when we obviously stood by the story. And the reason I remember that so well now is because he had offered, it turns out he offered to resign twice in that period. So what you get is this kind of blowback when they tell you it's not true, you're a terrible reporter, but then it turns out, guess what, you know. So there was another time I wrote that Condoleezza Rice, who was then National Security Advisor, was... from a source close to her, said that she would not be unhappy if Rumsfeld resigned, and that caused a huge to-do, where she dealt with my editor on that one. There was a lot of...
Bush himself, the president himself, did you say? Dealt with your
editor? No, she was dealing with my editor. Mm-hmm. The president doesn't usually get involved expressing displeasure about our stories. That's sort of beneath him. He has other people to do that.
Joshi's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Joshi. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Joshi here. My question for Elizabeth is whether or not she laughed at Stephen Colbert's spoof. Because at home,
did I laugh? Some of it I laughed at, yeah. I laughed at some of it, but I didn't think it was that, you know, frankly, I got criticized because I wrote a story about the Bush double. I just did a story from Monday's White House letter on
this is the Bush lookalike who sort of
who the guy was, how they got him involved. Bush had been interested in having this guy for years. I did sort of the backstories we say in the business, and I didn't mention Colbert, but good or bad, I just didn't mention him. And I was, you know, you can imagine the bloggers went berserk. And I didn't think he was that. I mean, I thought he was fine. I didn't think it was that. I didn't think he was that tough on us, first of all. I mean, I don't think that comment was that tough, and there was others.
Just take dictation, go home, and...
Aren't you aware of the... You see what the blog... That was nothing for us. And then the... I mean, you have no idea what my email looks like. And that was like a... Forget it. I didn't.
If it's like the blogs, it must be pretty,
you know, and
hot.
So then... I didn't think his criticism of the president wasn't... You know, again, I didn't think it was that striking. I mean, it was critical, but I just didn't think it was worth. I was doing something else. So, but nonetheless, we've been revisiting this for some time now.
No question, Joshi. What did you think?
I thought it was brilliant, and at home it seemed amazing. But to the people who were actually there, it seemed to not get very much of a reaction. So I was curious.
It didn't.
About
you know, it wasn't like
responsive.
I think it was different on TV. I don't know. We didn't. It just kind of didn't go anywhere. It wasn't like people were angry about it, or offended or anything. It just didn't work in the room somehow that well. But it was obviously one of these things where it was very different on television. I think he's very funny in the show, you know. And I mean, Jay Leno was the entertainment a few years ago, and he was hilarious. And as I recall, he was quite tough on Bush, and he brought down the house in that room. So that's not the issue, but it's kind of hopeless at this point to try and explain it.
Josie, thanks for your call. Looking back there, another fixture of the White House, Helen Thomas. Help us understand Helen. She's been very outspoken lately and very upset with the younger generation, maybe your generation of White House press correspondents. Says lapdogs, too timid. She wrote recently in The Nation, "I honestly believe that if reporters had put the spotlight on the flaws in the Bush administration's war policies, they could have saved the country the heartache and the losses of American and Iraqi lives," et cetera.
Well, that's giving us an awful lot of power that we could have stopped Iraq. But, you know, Helen is terrific. She's a legend. She actually was, when she was the UPI correspondent at the White House, previously, she now works for Hearst Newspapers as a columnist. She worked with my uncle, Frank Cormier, who was the AP correspondent at the White House. So our families sort of go back. And my uncle is departed. But Helen's a columnist. She's an opinion columnist.
Is now. Wasn't for a long time.
Right? She wasn't for a long time, but the entire Bush administration, she's been an opinion columnist. So she's kind of like Frank. She's like Maureen Dowd or Tom Friedman. And she still has a seat, and she's the only columnist who has a seat in the White House press room, and it's mostly because of her status. And so you just have to remember that's the difference between her and the rest of us.
It is for
now. I'm not an opinion columnist.
But this opinion, I mean, this is one pointed at your sort of generation. Here she is on April 5th at an event put on by Media Matters.
I think this is the worst press corps in terms of covering national and international news that I have participated in. The press corps obviously gave up its only weapon, which is skepticism.
She's a columnist. She deals in opinion now, but that's a tough opinion to take from someone who's been around that long.
Yeah, well, I mean, I obviously don't agree with her, but I do, you know, that's her opinion, and it's certainly an opinion shared by others, but I absolutely do not agree with Helen on that, and I don't think anybody in the White House press corps does, but she's... you know, and again, all I can say is she's a columnist, and she has opinions, and is allowed to write them in the way that the rest of us, you know, don't.
What is your sense of the president now, Elizabeth? Last fall, you wrote he was really back on his heels, had all kinds of problems piled up. Some have receded a bit, others haven't. His poll numbers way down. Maybe the Zarqawi killing has brought them back a little. I'm not sure yet. But what is your sense of his state of mind? Do you have a sense of it? Is it possible to say that you really do?
Well, it's hard. You know, I've been off the beat now for almost 2 weeks, so it's hard to say, and it was even hard to say when I was on the beat. But you get a sense of somebody who you see most days, and, you know, the thing about the president is that he's kind of, a lot of times, he's what you see is what you get with him. You can always tell when he's irritable and in a good mood or in a bad mood. I would say that... I can tell you that his advisors, the people who see him up close every day in the West Wing, have said for some time that he's been in a pretty good spirits this spring and summer, despite the poll numbers. And it's sort of hard to imagine, but they say that it was much worse last fall because there was all the rumors about the indictments, the Fitzgerald investigation into the leak. And there were rumors sweeping the White House that there were going to be 20 indictments, as we know.
Around Valerie Plame and all the rest. Yep.
Yeah. And it was also after Katrina. And the president has said privately that he feels that his administration took one of the worst hits imaginable on that because it really went to this issue of competence. And he saw the damage to that. Plus, his good friend Harriet Myers was under fire when he had nominated her for the Supreme Court. And she was just getting... trashed by Republicans and Democrats, and he took that very personally. He was also worried about Karl Rove possibly getting indicted. So people say that was really his, and Iraq was going badly. So people at the White House said that was really his lowest point, and that things are somewhat better now. And they say, and you say, how can that be? Look at his polls, and they say, well, look what we've been through. We've been through two wars. We've been through 9/11, and you know. He can weather this. The other thing I would say is that he is also looking ahead to his legacy. He's doing a lot of thinking about his library, his presidential library, and his thought is starting to think about creating some kind of a think tank to be attached to it. So,
is there a site already marked out in Texas somewhere?
Well, there's the favorite right
next to the ballpark.
Southern Methodist University is considered right now the favorite to get the library. There's a couple other Texas institutions, including Baylor University and Waco, vying for it. But SMU is considered the favorite. It's Laura Bush's alma mater.
If he's already
and
looking there,
Dallas.
Does that, to your mind, go to the Truman scenario? People saying, well, the president's imagining that he's, you know, all kinds of woe raining down on him now, but decades down the road, he'll be loved. Do you think George Bush sees the world and himself in those terms?
Well, what I can tell you, I love that question, because he gave a very little notice speech at West Point at the end of May, or right before I left the beat. I covered it, and it was a commencement speech, and it was a real, it didn't have much news in it, so it didn't get much attention, but it was a fascinating speech because it really went through and compared, first of all, it compared, you know, the administration's war on response to terrorism, the global war on terrorism, as he calls it, to the Cold War. And he went through very methodically. But basically what it was comparing the president to Harry Truman. And what he didn't say in the speech, but which was obvious, was that Harry Truman left office deeply unpopular. And it really took a generation for people to begin to appreciate his achievements. And obviously, I mean, the president has said this in interviews that, you know, I don't know what, you know, who knows what it'll be like. You know, who knows how I'll be remembered. We'll all be dead. But he obviously is, he does read a lot of history. He does read a lot of biographies of presidents. All presidents do that, and I always think that's interesting because I think they read them in a very different way than the rest of us.
No doubt.
But he does talk about how presidents are reassessed. He's talked about how George Washington was reassessed, and so I think that's part of maybe his decent spirits. He's looking ahead and realizing that, you know, in some ways this is out of his hands for the immediate future.
Michael's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you. My opinion is I kind of differ with the what she's been saying about the press being hard on President Bush. And I specifically say, take, for example, the prisons over in Europe. They've been documented in various newspapers around the world months before it was ever brought up before the president.
It's the so-called dark prisons, unnamed CIA prisons.
Right. And then, you know, questions like Saddam Hussein is linked to al-Qaeda, which, you know, half the people in the United States when that was going through didn't believe it because Saddam Hussein was terrified of al-Qaeda. And I don't think that the press was hard on President Bush and to make the premises he was. It goes against what I see every day. I get my news from other sources. I don't get it from the corps that goes up and asks the president. I get it months before, and then it finally gets up on national TV through the press corps.
Michael, we've got it. Elizabeth, there it is again. What should the country expect?
Well, we've covered, the New York Times covered all those stories. Actually, the secret prisons was a story in the Washington Post that won a Pulitzer Prize. I mean, the Post broke that story. Not our paper, but it's the mainstream press. It was a terrific story. I don't know where else you've heard about it. Yeah, I mean, my point is we've been covering those stories, and we certainly have written extensively about the Bush administration's claims, early on claims, that Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda were linked, and we've shot that down many times in many of our stories. So I would say we've been right on top of that. I don't know what else to say.
What do you think the famous secrecy of this administration does cost the country? I mean, if the administration is secretive, that means information doesn't get out in what we've come to think of as a normal flow. Is there a cost to that? How do you describe it? And what does it mean for the job of the press?
Well, of course there's a cost. And we don't know about, you know, it would be good to know about where these secret prisons are, who's in them, who's administering them, and so forth. Of course there's a cost whenever a society doesn't get all the, you know, information it needs. I would just say it just makes our job more important and harder, but it makes it more important. And I would, again, go back to my colleagues, Jim Risen and Eric Lishlaw on the the domestic spying scandal. Mm-hmm. I mean, they worked on that story for a year, and my God, they broke it. And by the way, they were the New York Times was one case where the president did get involved. The president called in the senior editors of the Times and the publisher and asked the Times not to print that story, and we did anyway. And so, you know, well, I mean, that's a powerful thing when the president calls you into the Oval Office and says, please don't print this in the interest of national security. So
now there's a threat from the Justice Department to use a 1917 Espionage Act to potentially prosecute reporters who put out classified information.
Right. That's there, too.
Is there a chilling effect? Can you feel it?
I don't feel it in my job because it wasn't as it, my the chilling effect was more just getting it. I mean, I don't. They weren't doing that to White House reporters. I think there's a, but I absolutely in Washington. I mean, it's. I can't say that it stops people from. It doesn't stop people from pursuing information and getting good stories in the paper. But what it has done is created a situation where there's a number of reporters in Washington who have criminal lawyers, just because they've been contacted by the FBI. And asked to talk, and the reporters say no. It's just it's part of the landscape right now.
There you go, a tape recorder, a pen, a notebook, and a criminal attorney to back you up. Sign of the times. Elizabeth Mueller, what's your next beat?
I'm on a leave to write a book about Condoleezza Rice.
All right.
That's what I'm doing next.
Great, terrific. We'll look for it, and we thank you very much for being with us
today.
Thank
you.
Elizabeth Mueller covered the New York the White House for the New York Times for nearly 5 years until about 2 weeks ago. Look for her book on Condoleezza Rice. Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Download the On Point podcast and subscribe to our daily newsletter all at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.